Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Well, we're talking about death today, but I assure you that this will be a more pleasant conversation than you might immediately assume upon hearing what we're talking about today, because we're talking about a book called Making Friends with Death, a field guide for your impending last breath, and then in parentheses, to be read ideally before it's imminent. The author of this intriguing book, Laura Pritchett, wants us all to think about death, about the end of our lives, and the way in which we want to die, the way in which we want those last moments of our life to play out. Where do we want to be? Who do we want to be with? What do we want that moment to be? And of course, it's important to say that it is not always possible for us to have the last word, because quite often that moment comes unexpectedly. But in those cases where we know that death is coming, what kind of choices are ours to make? And what should we think about as we make those choices? Laura Pritchett's book is a very intriguing look at some of these questions, and surprisingly lighthearted, actually. And that's one of the things that I like most about this book, which some might think of as a bit irreverent. It's actually refreshing to be able to think about some of these very significant matters, not with quite the same weight that we sometimes do. But this is not a book that's fun and games. It's a serious book at its heart, and one that really provokes deep thought. It's published by Viva. Again, it's called Making Friends with Death. And Laura Pritchett, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Aw, thanks for having me on.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. Tell our listeners about how you first started to become kind of intrigued with the notion of death and started thinking about it in a way that's probably pretty uncommon for someone of that age.
Well, two things happened. I was in my 30s, and I was helping my dad through 14 years of Alzheimer's and his slow decline, and I was also struck with my own healthcare crisis. And I was watching my father die and had several friends die recently, and all of a sudden I thought, man, I need to get my act together in case the worst happens. The diagnosis looked bad, and I was really scared. And so you're exactly right. Every book I read, it was helpful, useful, but they were so sad. And I thought, you know, one reason we don't talk about death more in this country, or that I'm not talking about it personally, is because it's so darn depressing. So what I wanted was a spunky, fun guide that admits it's all nuts and we got to do it anyway. I mean, death is sad. It's a sad beyond belief, but we can do it. We have to do it, and we can do it better, and at least point our ship in the right direction, think through some things. As you say, it might not go as we want it to, but there's a lot we can do to help both ourselves and our families and the planet and other things to have a good death, a better death.
One statistic you point out was quite fascinating to me, and I don't ever remember seeing this statistic before, that being that 1 in 10 of us will die suddenly and unexpectedly. and that for the rest of us, life to at least some extent will be what you characterize as a meandering death, but a death that does not come in an instant completely as a surprise, but something that at least to some extent we are able to anticipate. I just wonder that reality of the fact that 1 out of 10 will die instantly, unexpectedly. What does that do, or what should that do in terms of one preparing for death, if in some cases one has no way of knowing when death is exactly going to come, and where some of these choices that we might make are in a sense rendered meaningless because they're rendered in a sense inapplicable. Is it still important for all of us to be thinking about death in this way?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I'm so glad you asked that because, tragedies do happen. It's been in the news a lot, and I think, and it's serious and it's horrible. But I think, and we can't plan for it, but the one thing we can plan for is leaving behind some kind of written record for our loved ones that will bring them a lot of peace. So, for example, if you filled out this book or anything like this book, you know, any kind of wishes, partly about who you were and what you stood for and what you most believed in and where you'd like, you know, and practical things too, where you'd like your money to go or what causes you'd like to be a benefactor of, and where you'd like to be buried or put to rest. Those kind of things, if you do them when you're young and healthy, you know, I think this should be offered in college classes. You know, do it. You know, we do other things to prepare. Just do it now because we don't know what's going to happen. You could be one of those 1 in 10. That figure used to be much higher, of course, but now we have 911 and ambulances and all kinds of medical procedures. So it's a low number of people who die a sudden death, but those folks can prepare. And then you can also prepare before you know, even if you're going to have a meandering death, you can still prepare while you're still feeling great and nothing, you haven't received any bad news. I mean, I'm forever suggesting that people do this book before they are under duress. 20 years from now, they might be diagnosed with cancer and really be dealing with the stress of that and the medical procedures of that. But if they have some kind of written document already that outlines at least the basics, and some of the basics are fun, you know, like what music do you want at a ceremony? What kind of party do you want? I mean, some of it's fun, some of it's serious, some of it's logistical. But anyway, I advocate doing it now, when no matter what's going on in your life, just in case something happens.
I want to mention that you not only got to thinking about death for a couple of different reasons that you already pointed out, but also because you have been living with a rather difficult situation, a difficult medical situation that has caused you chronic pain. And it sounds like it is under decent control, but it is still a source of frustration. And I think it's probably safe to say that, especially in the early going, it was a source of suffering for you. What kind of effect has that had on what you think about in terms of death?
I think people who are in chronic pain can't but help think of death, in part because simply your cortisol levels are raised. You're in pain every day. Your body's under stress and duress, and death is going to be on your mind, and that's natural and okay. And, you know, it took a lot of therapy and talking to wise people to figure out that what I have is called trigeminal neuralgia. It's very painful, or it can be, but it's not going to kill me. In the early days, I wasn't sure what it was, and in the early days, I wasn't sure how I was going to cope with it. And in the end, you know, I got a regimen of good neurologists and drugs and helpful procedures and that kind of thing. And so I want to say to anyone in chronic pain, you know, stick with it, hang in there, because I didn't want to commit suicide, for sure. I had young children, and my fiction writing career was just taking off, and my life was beautiful, but I was in so much pain I couldn't help but consider it. And so I have a chapter in the book about chronic pain, and because they often go together, dying. One leads, you know, chicken and egg. You might be in pain and therefore dying, or dying and therefore in pain. But it's something serious to talk about and consider, but also, you know, smile and find your way through it if you can.
Hmm. Another interesting distinction made in your book is that there is the matter of preparing for one's own death and what it is that you hope you will experience, but also death prep for someone else. And this is a very, very intriguing notion indeed. And at one point, as you are talking about us prepping for the death of someone we care about or someone we love, you bring up the concept of being the confident guest. Explain to our listeners what you mean by that concept of being a confident guest.
I love that phrase, and thank you for asking that question. I say over and over again in the book that if you're helping someone die, the focus really needs to be on them. Certainly you need to do self-care and take care of your own emotions, but you're there to help them go through this transition in the best possible way, and that might mean advocating for their health care or pain control or peace of mind or giving a gentle massage or helping them arrange things. But it takes honesty and it takes courage and it takes presence. And you can't walk in, or I would suggest that you not walk in a room, you know, for example, your mother's room who might be dying, you know, tearful and crying and weeping and distraught and saying, you're going to get better, you're going to get better, when that's not true. Your job is to walk in there, look her in the eye and say, Mom, this is happening, and I'm so sorry, and let's talk about what you want. Let's talk about some really important stuff, because that will really help me. It will be a gift to me, and it might be a gift to you, and let's make these last moments wonderful as can be.
One of the other concepts very important in your book is of how reflecting on one's death, the fact that we are not here forever, can be a very powerful tool when it comes to, in a sense, reshaping our lives or living our lives differently than we otherwise might if we would go blithely on our way without really ever pondering and embracing our own mortality. At one point, you use the phrase that death can be our advisor. In what way is that possible?
Yes, I love the idea of using death as our advisor. And this is not a new concept to many, but I think it's great to keep on the mind and actually put into practice, because in little and small things, if you're using death as your advisor, you're going to keep your mind from focusing on the trivial and the vain, and you're also going to give your life priority and meaning. You know, for example, here's a small, silly example, but if I spill a blueberry on my shirt in the morning and have to go change shirts, I could get very upset and annoyed. I need to get to work, and now I'm late and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, if I can think, Laura, use death as your advisor, then I can calmly get up, change shirts, and go and smile and go on about my day, because I'm lucky enough to have this day and the blueberry, you know, spilled. So I think it just keeps everything in perspective, and it keeps us grateful for each day.
Many of the much of this book is devoted to very, very specific questions and very specific suggestions that can be part of this notion of thinking about one's own death and preparing for it, including the matter of, for instance, taking care of unfinished heart hurts, where you want people to maybe think about the people in their lives with whom they've had certain kinds of difficulties, writing out various matters of concern, such as what you might be frightened of and why, who you want to be surrounded with. One of the intriguing notions that I don't think will be very familiar to at least some of our listeners is something called the Death Cafe. Explain what the Death Cafe is and the benefit that it can potentially give to someone who wants to properly prepare for their eventual death.
Yes, well, this book is definitely a workbook. I mean, the idea of it is that it's very practical, hands-on, and if you filled it out and handed it to somebody, they would know exactly what you wanted in most arenas of your life and death. So it is a workbook, and it also suggests many activities, and probably one of my favorite is the Death Cafe. And that's a movement that's sweeping the U.S. It's quite popular in Europe and other places. I actually went to one in New Zealand that was a lot of fun. And then I threw one at my own house, and I had a cake that said, Death, the Final Frontier, and little hors d'oeuvres and so on. But in my case, I gathered a group of friends. You could also meet with strangers at a cafe. And the idea is to discuss death as a way to get this conversation started, this conversation that we are not having in America, and a conversation that can feel really lonely and isolating if you're not sharing it with somebody, whether strangers or friends. And so I offer several activities to do at the Death Cafe. One is to come up with a death mantra, which might be an image or a few last words that you would like to have in your mind at the last moment. Some of the activities are more fun. They talk about what you most stood for and you know, have some laughs about that, your happiest moments. So I've thrown several death cafes, and I encourage everyone to do it. It's a weird party, but, you know, who wants a normal party?
I also want to make sure, speaking of weird, to also have you explain the concept of practicing one's death. And this is something that you say you have indeed done. And lots of people you know have also practiced death. What do you mean by that?
Well, it can mean lots of different things, and I think other cultures have it as part of their regular traditions. I'm not sure we're so great at it in America, but one thing I literally do is sometimes get on the floor and cross my hands over my chest and say, "Okay, Laura, this is it. You're gonna go." And I practice how that might be. I can feel my blood pressure rise. I can feel the fear. I can feel me trying to calm myself through breath and meditation. I can feel the sorrow. And the more I do it, the better I get at it. I mean, it's just like practicing throwing basketballs or violin. You just get better and it gets easier. And who knows how my death will really go, but it brings me a lot of comfort, actually, to have said to myself, you know, I've done this before, or I've done something like this before, and it felt okay. I was able to recite my death mantra and think of my kids' faces and think of the five or six moments that made me really joyful, and bring all that to me and breathe and calm and breathe and calm. And I think by practicing, we just get better when the time comes, so that when the time does come, you know, we just got this one chance for most of us. And I want to do it right. I mean, some people don't care. They say, I'm dead. I'll be dead. Who cares? But I think most of us actually do care. And we would like that last moment to be full of, you know, our chins up and our hearts brave and full of equanimity and at peace. So that's what I'm shooting for. And practicing can help.
The book again is called Making Friends with Death, A Field Guide for Your Impending Last Breath, published by Viva, the author, Laura Pritchett. Laura Pritchett, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show and talking with me about your most intriguing book. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. This portion of WGTD's Morning Show is devoted to, in a sense, the scenario of the Brady Bunch, or closer to our own age, a certain storyline in Modern Family, namely the blending of families, the step-parenting challenge, which does not get talked about enough, although it is certainly a reality for more and more families. And a very thoughtfully crafted book has just been written called Blending Families, Merging Households with Kids 8 to 18. And I'm going to be speaking with one of the two authors of the book, Trevor Crowell Mullineaux, who is a licensed marriage and family therapist and a co-author of an earlier book called Forging Healthy Connections. In this new book, Blending Families, she and her co-author explore a number of different ways in which step-parenting can be a tremendous challenge and also a tremendous blessing, incredibly fulfilling and satisfying and joyous. But it is not always, in fact, maybe not often, an easy, effortless path. And they have included many real-life examples and stories about step-parents. And Trevor Crowell Mullineaux herself has some first-hand experience when it comes to the challenges of step-parenting. And I'm very excited to have this opportunity to speak about this book, which is published by Roman and Littlefield. Trevor Crowell Mullineaux, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Could you say a word first about your own experience, firsthand experience, in the realm of step-parenting, having both been a step-parent and having been step-parented, so to speak?
You are absolutely correct. So I met my kid's dad, and he had two children, one who is now 27. At the time, she was six, and her little brother was three. So we went on to have two children together. So my kids have half-siblings. Unfortunately, that relationship ended. However, I remarried a wonderful, wonderful man, and he has a daughter who's actually graduating today from the Hopkins School here in Connecticut. And so I've blended not only one, but two families, and my children currently have a stepsister, and they have half-siblings.
Hmm.
So it's a little complicated.
Right. And one of the things I appreciate about your book is that this is not just a book about I did this perfectly, and so here's how you do it. This is a story that acknowledges a more complicated reality, not only for yourself, but for all these other people that you also talk about who have grappled with the really special challenges of being a step-parent.
Yes, it is. It has its highs and lows like any other family group. But this is particularly tricky. And if you really walk into it with eyes wide open and knowing that there are alliances just naturally with your biological child, and it's hard to create relationships with step or half-sibs, it's really something you have to step into with thinking about it, wanting to be curious, very open-hearted, and with a lot of love and patience. And a little humor helps too.
I'm really glad that on the second page of the book, you grab hold of what I think some people are kind of sheepish about discussing, and namely what you were just saying, that there is a difference between the relationship between a biological parent and their biological child and a step-parent and their stepchild right from the beginning on a sort of fundamental animal way, is the way that you say it. In fact, you describe the way in which your first child, your own biological child, you tell us, smelled like flowers to me.
Mm-hmm.
and this is something you tell us that is, in a sense, hardwired for the typical parent. And that is something, of course, that is not going to exist in quite the same way with even the most loving, devoted step-parent.
Absolutely. And you know, that is part of the challenge and the complicated nature of all this, and also the feeling of great joy and love when you create a relationship with a child that you aren't biologically, you know, there is no DNA connection, yet we all can show up for each other. And how wonderful if we look at it from the child's perspective of, here's yet another adult who wants to love me and show up for me and listen and, you know, help with the resources, whether it's time or money or just, you know, watching the lacrosse game to feel like people are caring about me. So I really feel like it's made me grow as a person. I love my family and that all of these kids, whether they're related by blood or not, do literally show up for each other. Right now at this graduation, I've got the 27-year-old at the 17-year-olds, and there's no blood between these two, but they're sisters, and they really do care about each other. So
this is what I think, even though we're hardwired for this sort of animal connection, if we mindfully walk into the blending situation with this sort of love and patience and understanding that it's some work, and it's not, maybe not a natural connection. It's something you have to try for, but it can be really great, and it's very rewarding, actually.
Right. I think that's one reason why at one point in the author's note, you call it the blending adventure. and probably for somebody who's grappling with maybe the harsher realities of it, or maybe trying to blend under less than ideal circumstances, it might not feel like an adventure. But in fact, this is what it can be, especially when it's done well. In addition to being a step-parent yourself in a couple of different scenarios, you have also been, in a sense, step-parented. And I wonder if you could just say a word about the what you saw in the relationship between your own mother and the man that she later married when you were in your mid-20s, a man named Howard Stevenson. It sounds like you've taken great inspiration from the way in which they step-parented.
Mm-hmm. And they continue to do so, by the way. They're, they've been together, 28 years now, and they're a brilliant role model for me. And both Howard and my mom have been so loving. We really do have a Brady Bunch. There's four of us girls, and then my mom married Howard, who had three sons. We all never lived in the same house at the same time, but the two youngest, my younger sister and his youngest son Andy, spent much more time in the house. What I saw and what I learned, and I still take inspiration from today, is the two of them made their couple the focus and the strong boundaried foundation for the whole story. And they were very careful to be as fair as possible, as loving as possible, and giving us resources, again, whether it's money or time or advice. And they strived for that every step of the way. And, it, you know, of course, none of these things are ever perfect. But what they did really, really well is they never undermined each other. They always, you know, if you asked a question or pushed, you know, my biological mom on something, she always was like, nope, Howard and I are in a team. We're not going to separate on this. This is a decision we made together. So to me, that's the strongest, best way to start the blend, is it's really got to be in the couple where you love each other and you're just, you've got to, and this is a really tough thing to say, and a lot of people kind of wince when I say it, but you actually have to choose your spouse over your biological child over time. Because in the end, our kids are supposed to leave, just like any family, you know, whether it's an intact biological family or not. And we're forgetting, I think, especially in our culture today, that the couple, we need to nurture our relationship together, us one-on-one, two together, and then the children will all be safer, stronger, connected. If there's sort of this bringing the child up into the parental subsystem, it gets very waffly and unsafe and frankly dangerous. And it's not good for the child. It's not good for the couple. So my parents really did that. There really has been a hierarchy. You know, we're a team. You kids are not going to come between us, but we're going to show up when we can and the best we can and in a very loving way. So that's been a great role model and really truly has been set the stage for the way I've viewed and helped, you know, create these three families that I've been working with.
We're speaking with Trevor Crow Molino about her book, Blending Families, Merging Households with Kids 8 to 18. You say as the introduction opens that in a sense you choose to become a step-parent. In a way that becoming a biological parent is not always quite the same clear choice. I mean, obviously, to some extent, most of the time, there is some element of choice involved. But in your words, step-parenting reflects a conscious decision to form a family with children whose personalities you didn't help shape when they are little. They are children who do not have your genes. There is a lot you don't know about them physically, emotionally, and psychologically. In so many ways, they are strangers. I really appreciate the frankness with which you say that as well, because That's a reality that probably a lot of people in writing books like this probably are tempted to sort of dance around. And maybe people who live through this reality are also tempted to kind of dance around that reality. Strikes me as much healthier to sort of take that reality head on and be honest about it right from the start.
Well, thank you for that. And I did want to be really clear about this, that this is not a Pollyanna story, and it's very tricky and difficult for many, many people. And I've counseled families who are really coping with some difficult issues. But I do want it to be a very hopeful book, hopeful from the perspective of love is elastic. And as we show love to one another and we create a sense of safe haven in our homes where everyone belongs, everybody feels safe, everybody feels seen and heard and valued, that you actually create a great deal of healing for all of those individuals. And remember, when you're starting a blend, it's always from loss, whether a parent has died or there's been a divorce or a parent just abandoned or just never showed up. So there's a lot of healing that needs to happen. And if you can step into this whole story with this sort of sense of, yeah, you may not know these children, but if you give them a chance to grow and thrive and love them and show you really care and you're curious, I really believe that we can create these little tiny communities that can be so powerful and warm and loving. And that's really, to me, the rewarding and great point of all this.
Hmm. The first part of the book, called Opportunities and Challenges, includes an exploration of different kinds of attachment styles. And this is really, really interesting, and it includes a questionnaire that you invite the reader to take. And the way we answer these 10 questions can help us understand what our own attachment style might be. And I hasten to add that one's attachment style might be different in terms of your attachment style with your romantic partner versus your attachment style with, for instance, your children or your stepchildren. Explain this notion of attachment style, the different possibilities that are there, and why it's so important for us to know this about ourselves if we are about to embark on the adventure of step-parenting.
Well, we all develop an attachment style in 0 to 2 when our caregiver showed up for us or didn't. And given the nature of our own personalities, the environment, and how that person was responsive to us, we create, it could be a secure attachment, so you're healthy and secure within yourself. You could be anxious, which is you're always pursuing, you're never quite satisfied, you get very reactive if people don't reassure you. Or you can be an avoidant, have an avoidant attachment style, which means you really push your emotions down. You don't really identify what's really happening. You tend to step away, freeze or flee when things are happening. You kind of go numb, and you can't really be responsive because your own feelings have been so pushed down inside you. So that's an avoidant. And then the last attachment style is called chaotic. It's both of those things, the anxious and the avoidant coming together, which is, we call it come to me, go away. So if you're parenting from one of these attachment styles other than secure, if you're an anxious parent, for example, and your child is like pushing you away, trying to be a little bit more independent, saying, look, I need to go meet with my friends, and I'm developing my feeling of who I am out in the community, this around the 13, 14-year-old, 12-year-old adolescent stage, and an anxious parent may not really welcome that. They may feel rejected by the child or abandoned by the child, and they might pursue the child to come back and stay with them more often than they, please spend more time with me. But that's hard on the child as they're trying to create their own identity outside of the house. Now, a withdrawing, avoidant parent doesn't really talk to the child much about emotions because they're really not in touch with their own. The child might be in crisis, and the avoidant parent really doesn't have any tools to reach in and say, I see you're having trouble, come to me, let's talk, let's name your emotional place so we can resolve it together. An avoidant parent has difficulty connecting that way. So if we become aware of our own attachment styles in relation to our children and in relation to our partners, we really start to understand, I am reactive in this way. I don't have to always react that way. For example, I myself tend to be more of the avoidant type. So in my mind, I have to sort of slow down and go, instead of saying, oh, I can't deal with this anymore, I'm going to walk out, I'm going to get in my car, I'm going to drive down the street because I'm so frustrated. That's my usual style, by the way. I stop and I slow down and I tell myself, use your words. You can say right now you're getting frustrated. You can say to yourself, you can say to your child or even your spouse, I'm actually kind of overwhelmed. I don't even really know what to say. I'm having trouble dealing with this, or you start to get a little bit more vulnerable and more in touch with your own feelings, and then you bring the conversation to a very different place. Now, the reason why that is so important in a blended family situation is because emotions do get high. There are times when, for example, your spouse you feel like your spouse is aligning himself with his son or his daughter over you, and when that threat comes up in a couple, it's very important to really voice it. And as an avoidant, normally I'd be like, oh, well, I'm not going to deal with that, or I'll go, have lunch with my friend, or I'm just, but now I'm trying to teach myself to say, you know what, when you do X, Y, or Z, or you parent your daughter a little differently than my kids, I need you to understand what happens, how it lands on me.
Yeah, I have to say,
using my words.
Right. I have to say, by the way, my wife and I happen not to be parents. But as you're talking about these attachment styles, I'm realizing I would probably understand my wife and she would understand me better. And our relationship, which is very strong, very positive, would be even stronger and even more positive if we were mindful of each other's attachment styles. So I can see somebody who's not even a step-parent or even a parent at all really benefiting from maybe exploring this idea of one's own attachment style. And that could have ramifications, I suppose, even beyond marriage to and family, to the way one relates to friends and so on.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct. And we certainly learned since the mid-90s, there's a brilliant woman named Sue Johnson who has created emotionally focused therapy for couples. It's the only well-established, well-researched, evidence-based couples therapy that really addresses these attachment styles and helps couples calm down, have compassion not only for their own reactivity, but be able to step away and kind of go, oh, I see that's happening. My wife gets, her reactivity is she gets very anxious and elevated and escalated. And I can meet her when she gets to that place. I can reassure her and say, I'm here, honey. Let's bring it down together. I can show up for you in those stressful moments. So, yes, and a lot of Sue Johnson's and attachment theory has very much influenced, my style of therapy, but also this book.
Right.
So I owe a great credit to her.
I appreciate the matrix at one point that's shared about the three main young characters in the Harry Potter books, Hermione Granger and Ron Weasley and Harry Potter, as being, in a sense, examples of secure attachment style. That would be Hermione, Ron being the anxious, ambivalent type, and Harry being a bit more avoidant. And it's kind of fun to read what you say about that. And then you go on to talk about how this can have ramifications in terms of the way one tends to parent and the way in which one's parenting is seen. Is it more valuable to be mindful of one's own attachment styles, or does one also need to think about the children and their own attachment styles as well?
Well, if you get pretty good at recognizing your own reactivity and being able to say, okay, right now I can feel myself getting, and this is actually a checking in on your physical experience, because all of our emotions register in our bodies first. If you can stop and slow down and go, oh, I feel my stomach going into knots right now. Okay, before I actually start reacting in my normal way, whether it's withdraw or yell or whatever it is you usually do, you stop and slow down and go, okay, here's where I'm at. I can take a deep breath. And then the next piece, which is, it's a skill set and it takes a while. This is the 10,000 hour rule. Once you get to that place of sort of self-compassion, you can kind of check in and go, okay, what's happening with this child now? And that's important. That's a very important piece of this, which is if you know their styles and you're able to get them to understand their own stuff because you have compassion now, you have compassion for them. They learn and grow, and they can handle their, again, back to this, like, emotional resiliency. We're all much stronger and healthier when we can voice what's really happening for us in this very clear, authentic, vulnerable way. And if you create that safe place for that child to speak their truth, everybody grows, and it's a great feeling. And I'm always trying to work on it, because there are days when you're like just really mad at them, and you're like, you did what? But if you can calm down and go, okay, so what's the context? Give me what was going on for you. Why did you make those choices? Let me listen open-heartedly to this before I go really ballistic.
Right.
It can be hard.
Right. Speaking of being hard, I really appreciate the chapter in which you explore what you see as five of the most fundamental challenges that are part of this blending families process. And boy, they make a lot of sense. Putting the couple first can be very, very tricky. Resolving parenting differences, I suppose that's parenting styles and the different choices that different parents make. Communicating stability to the children, given the fact that, as you say repeatedly, most step-parenting situations are actually born of some kind of trauma. Setting the boundaries of step-parenting. And finally, establishing equality where there is inequality. I think all five of those right on the surface make a lot of sense. And, of course, it's good to read about more of the details, except the last one. I think the last one is the least obvious of the five. Can you explain what the significance is of this balance between equality and inequality?
Well, one of the big issues between, you know, putting a set of siblings, step-siblings together, is each of those families come from, they have different rituals, different values in many ways. And you have to celebrate the differences rather than judge the differences. So I like to call it, like, my stepbrothers are really great. They love kayaking and biking, and they're very much into green energy and responsible environmental sort of approach to the world. They have all these really great ideas, and I've learned a lot from them. And me and my sisters are all tend to be more, oh, we love to travel and we wear fancier clothes and we really don't go camping generally. And so we've loved and enjoyed a different kind of a style, if you will. And one of the things my parents have strived to do is say, oh, there's differences, but there's no better. You guys aren't better than the girls, or vice versa, that we celebrate those differences, and we're not going to create an unequal situation. And remember, some step families come together, and there can be a very giant financial difference between those two families. And so being sensitive to where your children are, how each sort of family group comes together, and understanding where maybe one might feel insecure or another might feel unsure, that you're just very attuned to how those differences can manifest, and reassure the kids that we're not going to pay attention to those. We're going to love you guys for who you are and celebrate and support those interests and those ambitions and drives. And cool, we're going to support that and go forward, but we're not going to set up they're better because they're, you know, vegan or something. I don't know. But the kids are hyper aware of these differences. So just being aware of that, and you'll be fine.
Right. This brings to mind something that gets talked about more than once in the book. That is contrasting two different television programs that each depict blended families, but in such different fashion, namely the Brady Bunch from the late 1960s, early 70s, and of course a program that's on the air right now, Modern Family, which many of us watch and love. And maybe we watched and loved the earlier show too, but the one really pays only the slightest attention to the reality of blending two families together. I mean, most of the time it could be just two parents with six kids and what happens, you know, with boys and girls and living in the same house. But Modern Family, in a sense, takes a much more nuanced, detailed, realistic approach to just how messy this blending process can be when you have different people making different assumptions and so on. I really appreciate that because, you know, in a nutshell, it helps us understand just how complicated yet how wonderful all this can be.
Yeah, you have to embrace the mess.
Let's finish by talking about five musts to succeed: trust, vulnerability, empathy, truthfulness, and structure. And was it hard to come up with this list of five, or did they present themselves very naturally and effortlessly to you?
I think between Marianne and I, we've worked together on now two books. She was saying, we really need to structure this in a way and show, like, these are some very clear points that help people, create a structure to build upon. And that once we started talking that way, they sort of flowed out in a really easy manner. And when those five points are in place, you can feel the strength of it. And the kids feel it, I believe, too. And that's how you, and as long as, you're embracing the mess, but also being able to adapt and to listen and to care, it all comes together, and it's fine and wonderful. Yes, there's always going to be messy moments, but again, it's doable. And that's why I really want everybody to understand there's a very hopeful piece of this.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
and I appreciate how this part of the book really goes into some detail about each of these concepts, which we're all familiar with, but sometimes turning those terms on their head or really helping us think about them in different ways. I want to finish by asking you about something that might surprise people a little bit. It's this notion that gets said more than once that if you're right about 30% of the time, probably things are going to be okay. Tell us where that comes from.
Well, a guy named Ed Tronick has done some really wonderful research around attachment styles and parenting. And if anybody wants to look on YouTube, there's a wonderful video called Still Face Experiment, and it's heartbreaking. But take a look at it, because that works even in adult relationships when you don't when you kind of shut down and don't relate that there's this mom and a baby and there's a dance and the mom just shuts down and the baby just can't deal with it and starts to cry and just makes you cry. But we even do this in adult relationships. Anyway, past that. I lost my train of thought.
We're talking about the 30% of the time.
Right. I'm sorry. So Ed Tronick came up with the number 33%. So we can't show up and be responsive and loving and kind 100% of the time. And so after all of the experiments that he'd been doing in his research, he discovered that really doing it well 33% of the time is fine, and that's a very forgiving number. And I love it, and I remind myself of it, because we will mess up, we will fall down, and there's something called an apology. And I believe so much, and especially as a step-parent, I recently had to apologize to my stepdaughter because I did something that was really unacceptable. And just being able to say, look, I really messed up, and I'm going to do my best to do better, those are, again, healing moments for everybody. So 33% of the time, I think, gives us all a little space to say, you know what? It's okay. You can mess up, you can apologize, and you can pick up and keep going and still build.
The book is Blending Families, Merging Households with Kids 8 to 18, published by Roman and Littlefield. One of the authors, Trevor Crowe Molyneux. Trevor Crowe Molyneux, I thank you for writing such a wonderful book and for joining me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg, and what a great interview. Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Richard Chilton, the author of Adventures in Old Vines, a look at the world of wine and some suggestions on how one can become an intelligent wine connoisseur. On Wednesday, Margot Kahn, the author of This is the Place, a collection of very thoughtful essays by a number of